So now we go to Patrick Wynn. Patrick Wynn is the interview for this week. I am so glad that I get to share this with you. He is somebody who constructed this narrative around the Wa indigenous people in Southeast Asia. You're going to hear about the narco trafficking operation that they have, but then we're going to go deeper and you'll get to hear all the nuances about them, the way in which the CIA became entangled. The DEA is over there trying to shut down their operations. And then at some point there is a kind of hero or a figure that rises. His name's Saw Lu, and he is a kind of warrior and also someone who decides to become an asset of the DEA to try and help them find a way out, to say, hey, we will shut down this heroin operation and we'll stop exporting these drugs if you can help us with our liberation. So I got to talk with Patrick for quite a long time, and I'm excited to share. Patrick is an investigative journalist who has covered rebellion and black markets in Southeast Asia. He's been doing this incredible reporting for 15 years. He gained special access to the Wa. And if you're saying, who are they? Just wait, you're going to learn. And like I said, author of Narcotopia, In Search of the Asian Drug Cartel That Survived the CIA. So stick around, coming up here in just a few seconds. You can watch it. And I'll be back here next week in the Nook to talk with you. Until next time, thank you for supporting this show. Hi, hello, everyone. I'm joined by Patrick Wynn. Thanks for being here to discuss your new book. Again, Narcotopia, In Search of the Asian Drug Cartel That Survived the CIA. I was thinking that a good way to begin would be to discuss simply, because I believe I have a pretty above average knowledge of the world, and I read about what's happening in the Middle East. I know stories from Africa. I follow Latin American politics. A lot of this is all through the lens of U.S. foreign policy and things of that nature. But that being said, I have some idea. I had no idea about what was going on in this segment. And even though it if you did the Venn diagram, if you did a cross section, it would intersect with the history of the Vietnam War somewhat, which you bring into this, the fact that, American GIs are having the ability to partake in some of the drugs that are coming out of this region. So that being said, let's begin simply. I know there's a primer out there. You are a correspondent for The World, which airs on NPR stations globally. You're able to do a bit of a basic primer on your book, but I don't want to presume that anybody truly knows what we're talking about here. Why don't I just have you begin by telling people who the indigenous people are of the Wa and what the Wa state is, and its location, and why you were drawn to tell this story.
Yeah, and thanks so much for having me. You're in very good company. I'm very people know of the Wa. One of the reasons I wanted to write this book is just to show people that the American Empire has such vast reach, and it has had an effect on indigenous groups that you've never even heard of, people that you've never even heard of. So even though Americans might not know anything about the Wa people, their civilization has been convulsed by various U.S. government operations through the decades. So who are the Wa? The Wa are an indigenous group native to this mountainous area where Burma meets China. It's really mountainous, like almost as much as the Rockies, just like peaks, valleys. And there are about a million of them. And if you were to ask someone in Southeast Asia who was familiar with this group, unfortunately, they're highly denigrated. So one of the first things they might say is, oh, those headhunters. So that comes from the fact that up until about the 60s, indigenous Wa people did live in these walled settlements, these like fortress-like settlements, and they did have warriors within those settlements that practiced headhunting, so literally cleaving enemies' heads off and putting them on sticks. And as I point out in the book, French revolutionaries also severed people's heads, and they had their reasons too. It was a deterrent. It was kind of a shocking thing that kept intruders away. So why were they so compelled to keep people off their turf? Well, the British had tried to colonize them. Burmese dynasties had meddled with them. Chinese dynasties had come for them as well. And within the culture, there's just a very strong independent streak. So that's something that is a through line throughout this whole story. Probably the latest that would have been practiced would have been the 60s. Since then, they have gotten organized and developed their own nation state. So in the late 80s, early 90s, we saw the rise of this place called Wa State. This is their own, I don't know what else to call it, but a nation state. I mean, it doesn't have its flag up on the wall at the UN, but it has its own government with ministries of health and finance and highways and a national anthem and an electricity grid and schools and hospitals and all that stuff. It exists entirely within the borders of Myanmar, but it's totally autonomous. The government of Myanmar has no say over their laws, has no say over their leaders. So it's really one of the most fascinating places in the world. And I'm sure we'll get into this over the years. It's been, it's drawn the attention of both US spies and US anti-narcotics agents.
Yeah, and as your book was about to be released, you put together a thread that was posted on social media. And I'm just going to put this excellent photo up here. This is, I did the wrong two shot here. Let me. Here it is, of you meeting with Saw Lu, who is the figure that you make the, for lack of a better term, but just because it's how we understand storytelling in the United States, this is your hero. This is our protagonist that you have. Again, I'm not saying that like that's your viewpoint of him. You take a very complex and nuanced view of him, to be clear. And there are many different aspects to him, which I think, I give you the opportunity to share here. You follow this figure, Saw. And as you mentioned, you're here at his home in 2020. You're telling his story and you go after the different people that he intersected with. In order to fully tell what his life was like. And I think in your view, when you spoke to him, the story, the biography of Saw Lu is in many ways the history of the Wa State. Would you say that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I tell the history of this what the U.S. would call a rogue nation state or a narco state through his eyes. And just to give you the context, lots of narcotics are produced on Wa soil and have been for decades, originally heroin and more recently methamphetamine. So in the eyes of the DEA, Wa State is just sort of like a jungle mafia that, should be dismantled. The story of the book and the story of Saw Lu shows that this is, it's not, you can't just treat it like a cartel in Sinaloa. You can't just treat it as a for-profit, strictly profit-seeking criminal enterprise. It's really, there's a drug cartel that's the financial engine of a nationalist project, a nationalist agenda to preserve their homeland. So to intro Saw Lu, I should back up and explain that for about 10 years, I've been trying to talk to the leaders of Wa State. It's a place that's ruled by a Politburo, so sort of a ruling council. Much of the senior leadership they're called drug lords by the DEA and they're indicted. So trying to get an interview with them, not easy, to say the least. I've been rebuffed many, many times. 5 years ago, I made the acquaintance of a former officer in the WA government, and we were in Myanmar at the time, in a town about 50 miles away from where the WA territory begins. And he knew what I was trying to do. And he said, listen, I want to introduce you to my father-in-law. And we went up the road into this compound with all these security cameras peering down and through this iron gate and into a living room. And we sat down on some wooden furniture, and in walks a former top three leader of WA State, which it was quite an astounding moment for me. I didn't know how much he would want to say to me, but as we began talking, you know, he quickly asked, he's like, you're American? I said, yes, also a journalist. These are usually things that would get you thrown out in the presence of a WA leader, but he said, no, it's okay. What do you want to know? So we sat and talked until about midnight that night, and I just kept coming back and kept coming back and kept coming back. And eventually he told me, I mean, by the time I finished speaking with him, I didn't have any other questions left. He was a totally open book. I'm sure we'll get into this. One of the more profound things about Saul Liu is he wasn't just a typical WA leader. He also had a long history of being a DEA asset. And that's why he was probably comfortable talking with someone who looks like me.
Right, exactly. So let me put this other photo just so, you know, we saw him as an aged figure, this is Saw, for people listening, I'm putting an image on screen of him in his fatigues. And is that anybody important next to him in the photo, or is
No one I recognize. No, but that's Saw Liu in prime DEA asset mode. That's him in the early 90s, and he's smoking on the most massive bong anyone has ever seen. It honestly is as big as a bazooka, but he's smoking tobacco. He didn't really drink that much, and he absolutely abhorred like hard drugs like narcotics, but he liked his pipe.
All right, so since we're to this part of your book, let's go ahead and bring it in, and I'll go ahead and do it through Saw because it is the main central figure of your book. You have a quote that you write, or these words that you write in the book that basically says that as WA poison flows into American cities, we make enemies of the strongest country on earth. That was at least the perspective of Saw, and part of, if not a large part of his motivation to go to the DEA and become, as they refer to him, the confidential informant, they call him Superstar. And I presume that at some point in your reporting, you came across this code name that it didn't like, you didn't just know that this code name existed for Saw. Which probably was a remarkable part of your reporting when, you know, it dovetailed together that are talking about this person and it also happens to be Saw Liu. But yeah, I mean, this important thing of, I think what I really want to have you emphasize and speak to as we take advantage of the podcast format and bring out these nuances that are important to your book. What I take away here when I think about the WA and how, you know, now they're aligned with China, but previously they were seeing that there were advantages to coming to the United States government and trying to reap some kind of benefits for their people, that this really is a group of indigenous people that looks at the globe and tries to figure out what could most benefit their population. And they're not unique. I'm sure there's other populations throughout the world that do that, but these are people who are fairly astute about looking at power politics and trying to make sure that it gives their people the best possible future.
Yeah, I'm glad that came through because like I said, the Wa are so vilified and have been for so long. The, you know, they've been called savages, and the British colonizers called them ogres. And even on the Chinese side, Chinese dynasties called them, you know, ugly, and it's just all this really, really nasty stuff. And it creates this portrait of a simple people or like a benighted people. No, from my reporting, what I found is a very clever strategic mode of thinking. So, okay, we are up in this landlocked mountainous region. We don't have many friends in the world. Our soil is really poor, so they can't grow crops very well. They can't really grow anything that has much value other than the opium poppy. The opium poppy grows beautifully in their territory. Opium poppies love like bitter soil and chilly weather. So they're kind of steered through geography towards the drug trade. And they have a choice. Once they found their own state, do you lean into being a drug trafficking organization with a nation wrapped around it and just accept that that's going to bring scorn and fury from the United States, which was waging the drug war at the time, and just try to tough it out? Do you go super militant? Or this was Saul Liu's vision. His idea was, okay, let's actually present America with an option. You don't have to make us targets. You don't have to make us pariahs. You could bring in American aid and modernize us, hospitals, schools, roads, all that stuff. Send in expertise from the United States, build us up, and we will willingly wind down the drug trade. And this was happening. This offer was extended through Saul Liu to the DEA of all people. I mean, you can imagine one of their informants turning around and, you know, instead of asking for more cash or more cigarettes or whatever, saying, no, I have this grand dream that where the DEA becomes friends with a drug cartel. A totally unusual and unorthodox way of waging the drug war. In the early 90s, when this is happening, I remember it, I was young at the time, but heroin epidemic, it was all over the newspapers, the grunge era, people are ODing left and right. And the DEA did have a lot of backing in Washington to wage that drug war. And here was an opportunity to shut down one of the bigger drug producing organizations in Southeast Asia without firing a single shot, without spilling a single drop of blood. So that offer was presented to the DEA through Saul Liu.
Right. And so let's get to this history that you have in the book. I'm going to put up another thing you shared in your thread, which was a document that featured the CIA's opinion or viewpoint of the Wa. And I'll just go to it here. Basically, in this report that came from 1953, they're saying, in general, the Wa people are strongly opposed to communism. Some of their people were taken to communist China for propaganda purposes and indoctrination. One group was permitted to witness the execution of 300 persons on a single day in a direct attempt to intimidate the hillsmen. The device did not succeed. The Wa have a special feeling of affection and respect for white men and are unanimous in their desire to have the white man assist them and even rule them.
Unanimous.
I could be facetious and ask if that was your own experience when you ventured into the Wa state, but I presume you weren't suddenly revered like you were some kind of like Howard Kurtz figure in Apocalypse Now, and that it's, you know, very dehumanizing to paint them in that way. So maybe contextualize this perspective and also just to bring out the nuance again. I think an important wrinkle to your story is this aspect of how the CIA is here before the DEA, which gives the DEA a disadvantage, it would seem, in going after the different narco trafficking operations that are happening.
That memo was written sort of early Cold War, and the CIA saw this indigenous group with a warrior reputation right on the back door of communist China. And that's why you get these diluted ideas about white men ruling them. I think all of your listeners will quickly draw the conclusion that, of course, they didn't want anyone to rule them. Okay. But the CIA at that time, during the Cold War, up through the 60s, had a system that I call narco espionage. Essentially, they would use drug runners who were very good at crossing borders and very good at going to distant and semi-dangerous parts of Southeast Asia to gather intelligence. And it actually makes a lot of sense. They sort of offloaded that responsibility to drug traffickers, and not all of them, but certain drug traffickers who also shared their anti-communist views. So in that context, they saw the WA and they saw an opportunity. The CIA in general, I really try to stay away from the wilder conspiracy theories that, you know, the CIA controls the drug trade. No, it's not that. It's that they will use any asset they can to gather intelligence. And also they understand that narcotics bring with it a lot of power and money. And so they would like to make sure that one of their rivals or some rival ideology isn't tapping the power of narcotics to, say, create a state or destabilize a state that they don't like. That's their overall remit. By the early 70s, we have Nixon and we have the war on drugs, and we have the DEA as this globe-trotting police force. It's really never been anything like it in the world, where you have American, essentially law enforcement in foreign countries arresting drug traffickers so that they won't traffic it all the way to the United States. And that brought the DEA and the CIA into a direct collision, because the DEA, you know, they're cops. I mean, they see things pretty black and white. They want to arrest drug runners. The CIA is fine with that. And in general, the CIA and the DEA can be simpatico. The CIA might even provide intelligence, like satellite intelligence, to the DEA to help them catch a certain drug trafficker if, and usually they don't, if that trafficker has absolutely no intelligence value to the United States. But in this situation, the big boys did have a relationship with the CIA. And so that brought the DEA and the CIA into a direct collision. I should add that the CIA's entanglement with drug trafficking organizations in Southeast Asia kind of fizzled out by the early 70s. I think there's a little bit going on in the 1980s. The CIA often, in a major way, would have its junior partner or work with its junior partner, Taiwanese military intelligence, to do some of that. And then if the Taiwanese gathered intel, that would be sponged up by the CIA. But that starts to fizzle out, let's say, by the 80s. And once the WA state is formed, there is no relationship with the CIA and the WA anymore at all. From early 90s onward, WA state is seen as a target of the CIA. And I'll hasten to add, not the biggest target. This, I don't think they were, like, you know, marathon meetings held at Langley about the WA. And the point of my book is that it doesn't take much of a nudge or a push from the United States to destabilize a pretty small ethnic group, only 500,000 to 1 million people. It can be a low priority for a group like the CIA, but it can be absolutely momentous for that group.
To go back to Saulu, the way that he comes to the DEA and asks basically for the U.S. to help the WA secure their liberation, you don't need to go into all the details, but I do think it's a major takeaway from your book that, you know, he comes to these people who are working in these institutions. Allegedly, you would think that they would want to make this possible, but it shows you the limits of what they're willing to do, because, you know, he's saying, take out all of this drug trafficking, give us these things that, you know, honestly, if we just use something that people have a common reference for, these are the types of institutions, buildings, or structures, infrastructure that we said we were going to construct in Iraq after, you know, after occupation, that the U.S. said you're going to build up to reconstruction. He's basically saying, reconstruct us from the ground up. You know, we've never been developed. We're an impoverished people. And the way that they shrug and are hugely cynical to it, maybe you have a comment on, you know, the aftermath, like what we're dealing with now as a result of the U.S. government not taking this request more seriously.
Yeah, and I know I will get a lot of pushback from certain DEA agents who will, you know, maybe laugh at that idea that they could partner up with the drug cartel. I mean, just so people understand, this Salu guy, he convinced all of his DEA handlers, almost all of them, that this was a good idea. And they forwarded it upstairs to DEA headquarters. And people in DEA headquarters were very willing to explore the idea. I mean, it was going on the road towards actually happening. I know it sounds hard to conceive of the DEA having like this alternative to waging the drug war as we know it, right? But it really gained a lot of momentum. That is where the CIA stepped in and sabotaged it. I think what's hard to convey is how a lot of this can come down to personality clashes and just rivalries. I can't tell you that the CIA sabotaged the idea because it was fundamentally opposed to the WA uniting with America. Hey, maybe in some other country, if things stacked up a different way, they would be the ones pushing that idea, right? But the politics at the time made it so that they were pretty unhappy with that and pretty unhappy with Saul Liu. The reason is, at the time, the Cold War had just ended and the U.S. was, I think they were searching for new dragons to slay. Burma, Myanmar, same country, two names. Burma had a military regime that was and is truly awful. And it was the agenda of the CIA and the State Department, the two work very close together, to minimize Burma, to weaken it, as one ambassador explained it to me, or one diplomat explained it to me, basically make it a sponge for the human rights initiatives of the State Department and the United States. So Burma was persona non grata. Well, here's where things get complicated. The DEA was pretty buddy-buddy with the Burmese regime, and they had brought them into this plan to sort of flip the WA into a modernized statelet within their territory. And the Burmese were going to go along with it. And what would have happened if they did that is Burma's regime would have looked heroic, at least for a week. I mean, there would be screaming headlines about how heroin production in Burma plummets. And this went against the agenda of the CIA and the State Department, which was to vilify Burma as much as possible. So it came down to the CIA not really trusting the WA to begin with, disliking the DEA and anything that they were excited about, particularly in that country, and ultimately just feeling that the DEA had gotten way too big for its britches. I mean, the CIA see the DEA as cops. Like, what are cops doing reshaping geopolitics, even on this rather small to medium level? So it just brought these two institutions into a major, major collision, and the CIA did not want it to happen. And so through certain covert methods, they ruined the reputation of Saul Liu, and they made life pretty miserable for the DEA agents that were working with him. And the upshot is that the WA realized that the United States was just not a viable partner, that they couldn't be trusted. I mean, they're talking about making an agreement with the U.S. government, and the U.S. government seems to be split into two factions who are like clashing and butting heads. So the WA, that was really the beginning of the WA going fully wholesale towards China.
Yeah, what you're saying, I was really struck by, I think you call it an ethnography you do for the CIA and the DEA to give people, again, to give people who have all these sensational ideas, rightly or wrongly, about what these agencies are. I mean, I think one of the things about one aspect of the CIA and DEA that you can't ignore is that these are agencies that have quite a presence in entertainment, we'll just say. So people have a lot of imagination, but then there's also chapters in these agencies' histories that color people's opinions of them as well. So I thought the breakdown, which was good, that I think some people know in the back of their head, like they could guess that there's the difference, but it was important to me. And so maybe you want to speak to how that manifests in Burma or with the WA, you know, the fact that you do have the CIA. I think you described them being more like necktie wearers and stuff like that, or they sit behind a desk, versus DEA, as you say, that are more like cops that are willing to go out there and I guess get their hands dirty.
It's I was being very cheeky when I wrote that ethnography of the CIA and the DEA, because that's usually something that we Westerners write about tribal groups, right? And I just hey, even the DEA guys that I talked to for writing this book would admit that it gets pretty tribal. Yeah, this is especially true of 70s, 80s, 90s. CIA guys typically more from an Ivy League background, more of a well-heeled background. Today, I think it's a little bit different, but then definitely. They kind of are trained to feel like they're masters of the universe, in that, you know, as a CIA station chief told to me, like, look, DEA agents, for them, the law is the law, but for the CIA, we're allowed to break laws. And he very quickly added foreign laws, not U.S. laws, but yeah. But when you feel like you have the authority to break laws and go to other countries and break their laws, I mean, they're given godlike powers, and they use them. And there really is a culture in the CIA of thinking that no matter how strong America is, it's somehow always like in peril. And you have to take these extreme measures to protect it and save it. And I think it just attracts a lot of very intelligent, but really competitive people as well. DEA guys, especially the ones I talked to, you could just kind of picture them like flipping hamburger patties in the grill backyard, more working class stock, you know, more like the background of law enforcement. And you know, there's a culture in the DEA of good guys versus bad guys, and you'll hear words like scumbags thrown around. I brought probably a bit of a bias into writing this, not being a massive fan of the drug war and having grown up during it and receiving this really draconian anti-drug education in school. But I have to say that a number of the DEA agents that I talked to, while they were enmeshed in that system, meant well, and they were practical. I mean, that's how you get these DEA agents who are willing to go to their bosses in DC or outside DC and say, I know this sounds crazy, I got this guy, he's high up in one of the major drug producing organizations in the biggest heroin exporter on earth. How about we build them some schools and hospitals and call it a day, and we'll shut them down. So there, I think, is something to admire in them being able to see that that was a possibility, or there was another way to do things. I don't know enough about the DEA globally to know if they ever considered tactics like that in other places. But from what I gather, it's been pretty bang, bang, lock them up everywhere else.
And there's an episode in your book that I'd like to have you highlight. Obviously, people should read the book to get the full sense of what happened. But I thought this was a stark illustration of the dynamic between the CIA and DEA. This was for me where I think, you know, you most prove the, I guess if you're making an argument about where the CIA fits and who populates it versus the DEA, you do a pretty good job through the example in 1980 of this incident that happens of the DEA heads in Chiang Mai in Thailand, and his daughter is taken hostage. You can get into, please get into, you know, why this happened. But I think you learned of this primarily through Angelo Saladino. Is that where you're getting this from? I believe he's talking about this story. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. I did. He's somebody that I still keep in touch with. He was really gracious.
In the DEA. Sorry, but I should introduce. Angelo is in the DEA. I'm just throwing names out like people would know who they are.
Yeah, he in this part of the story, he's a DEA agent in northern Thailand, which was a hotbed for heroin trafficking. But, you know, the encapsulated version of this story is in Chiang Mai, you got the DEA, kind of the new kids on the block, and you have the CIA who've been there like since deep Cold War, communicating with drug trafficking organizations, and they're really clashing and really not getting along. They're also in the same building. So there's a consulate in the city of Chiang Mai. Maybe people have been backpacking there or something. It's like a tourist destination now, but a consulate, like ostensibly for like if a backpacker loses his passport or something, but inside and still, there is a DEA and a CIA presence. So they're not getting along. As you mentioned, the head DEA agent in Chiang Mai at the time in 1980, his wife and young daughter are like held hostage at gunpoint while they're out shopping in a market. The hostage taker doesn't get away. He's surrounded by Thai police, DEA agent, his name is Mike Powers, comes in and convinces the hostage taker to let the kid go, but he still has his wife at gunpoint. And we don't know exactly what happened, but the guy's gun goes off. He sadly kills the DEA agent's wife, and then he's just lit up by the Thai police and killed himself. So in this scenario, everyone is asking, what the hell was this about? Who hired this gunman to do this to a DEA agent's wife? And suspicion fell on a major drug trafficker in the area named Khun Sa, but it wasn't proven. So the DEA thought, CIA, you know, with you've got like ears in all sorts of murky places, like surely you can help us definitively figure out who ordered this hit. For the most part, the DEA guys were frozen out, and Angelo Saladino, who we just mentioned, was one of the DEA agents there. Frozen out. He and his peers did not get a lot of assistance from the CIA, and it was this really dark point for these two organizations. It kind of set the stage. It was at least a very, very strong example of how difficult it was for them to get along. I should add that, you know, perhaps in other countries in that very year, DEA and CIA folks were getting along just fine because they didn't have any particular conflict. But when they do have a conflict, the CIA is just a much more powerful organization. And the DEA can get as mad as it wants, but it ultimately knows that the CIA can do what it wants. I mean, this comes up a lot in my book, bugging phones. Okay. It's pretty well understood in the DEA. The CIA will bug your phone. I don't know if they're still doing it, but these were examples from the 80s and 90s. It's not legal. So under the Constitution, the CIA is not allowed to just, without a warrant, wiretap a fellow federal. Yeah, you can't just do that. I mean, you have to have a reason. You can't just wiretap anyone you want if they're an American citizen. But I talked to so many DEA guys that said that was happening, and they just learned to live with it. That's how little trust there was.
Right. And I think, we don't have to go into it. People, I hope, get a chance to see the examples. But sometimes, it's cloak and dagger tactics on the part of the DEA to try and evade the CIA because they have their own objectives that they have to achieve. So let me ask you, I just have a couple things for you as we wind this down. I did want you to address, because, it's such an important part of U.S. history, a defining moment in shaping U.S. foreign policy, the malaise after it, people pausing, hesitant to go get quick into gigantic interventions abroad. The idea that these American GIs over in Vietnam are being exposed to these drugs. As I read the book, it seems like the soldiers that were deployed to Vietnam really are the kind of like gateway for the WA to get their drug into the United States. Did I read that correctly?
More or less. I would just say that they were all the GIs deployed to the Vietnam War were a fantastic gift to all of the drug traffickers in that entire Southeast Asian region. At that time, the WA by and large were on a lower rung, meaning they were primarily farming opium, which was bought by another organization, which was CIA linked, and then synthesized into heroin. The WA at that point hadn't figured out how to synthesize the heroin themselves. So WA opium up in the mountains, bought by an organization headquartered in Thailand. And then that cartel sells it in the open market and it makes its way to Vietnam. Why was this such a gift, these U.S. soldiers coming to Vietnam? Well, they had money and they had a monthly stipend. And it wasn't a lot of money by, say, U.S. standards, but it was enough to buy vials of heroin with some regularity. Well, if you are a Southeast Asian seller of heroin in 1968, there's only so many people that can afford your product. It was a very agrarian, all these societies were very agrarian. So if you're a rice farmer, I mean, you barely have a reason to even handle cash anyway. Maybe you have a little bit of cash and you go buy sugar and salt and stuff from the local market, but you're not throwing around cash to buy heroin. You're actually so spread out in so many different villages that you're not that in an urban environment where you would buy the heroin. Just now you have all these American soldiers who are naturally traumatized because they're fighting this awful war, and they're all kind of concentrated in one place, and they were perfect people to buy heroin. I'm not saying everybody, all the GIs that were in Vietnam were doing heroin. Enough were to sustain the market. I mean, I found a CIA file that they were looking at heroin labs going up on the border of Thailand, directly attributing it to demand from the US GIs. So the CIA knew who was buying it. Of course, the war ends, the US soldiers go home, and the natural conclusion from the heroin producers of Southeast Asia is, we got to get it to them 8,000 miles away across the Pacific. And that taught a very important lesson to the traffickers in this region that, Americans are voracious consumers of narcotics. Were back then, still are. It's the golden market if you're trying to sell drugs. And so at great effort, they forged these new trafficking pipelines all the way to the U.S.
So there's a point at the end of your book where you mention that some of these people involved in drug trafficking have moved on to cryptocurrency. I just have to mention that. I don't know why, but like, people don't really want that to be stigmatized as a thing that is going to be part of like dark web or for people who are engaged in black market activity. But maybe that's not the case in the US, but it would seem to be that you're suggesting there, or not suggesting, but you're showing why the DEA at least would be taking an interest in people's use of cryptocurrency.
Yeah, they use, I don't know too much about crypto, but they use this particular crypto, I think it's called Tether, but it's tethered to the US dollar. Yeah, a lot of that has to do with the fact that the WA are sanctioned and they're cut off from the global financial system. So most people don't know this. I didn't know it until I started reporting this book. So corporations can be people under US law. We all know that. Trafficking organizations can be kingpins under US law. So the entire corporation, the entire drug trafficking organization that is WA State, which is this highly functioning government with tens of thousands of officials from truck drivers to nurses to the leaders, are all this like one, legally, this one cumulative kingpin. And so if any U.S., anybody with exposure to the U.S. financial system conducts a transaction with them, you know, you or I, and non-U.S. citizens too, if you have a bank account in California, but you happen to be from Mexico, that would count too. You can't conduct a transaction with a WA official because that will mean you're infecting the U.S. system with dirty drug money. So it effectively walls them off from having a normal economy. They weren't going to have a great economy anyway. Like I said, they're landlocked. Their soil is terrible. The mountains are just not, it's not a place where you can base a thriving economy. But under U.S. sanctions, they're total pariahs. I would argue that if you wanted them to produce less drugs or have less drugs produced on their soil, you might want to give them a window through which they could make money doing something more legal. But no, I don't make policy.
The book is really about the indigenous people of the WA. I thought you said something very eloquent about how, you know, the WA should have the right to be several things at once, just like the United States. And that's probably the most humanistic takeaway that you could walk away with if you read the book. I hope that people who get a chance to read the book and should read the book would, as they're introduced to the WA. I mean, I think the good thing is a lot of people don't even know that these people exist. Yeah. So it's hard to have prejudice about the WA, which is really good. But then once you're introduced to them, you know, to say, okay, I mean, it's remarkable because you mentioned, last thing, I'll give you the final words here, is you include in the author's note that the UN Office on Drugs and Crime in 2019 says that the Southeast Asia's narcotics economy is worth up to $71.7 billion. Meth is $61.4 billion. Heroin is $10.3 billion. Comparatively, Myanmar's GDP is $69.2 billion in 2022. All right, so this drug operation is bringing in billions upon billions of dollars. You said in our discussion that they're landlocked, there's not a lot of opportunity for them. So what else are they going to do? As long as people around the world are consuming heroin and meth, this is what they're going to do, and this is the way that they are able to prosper. That doesn't mean they're only interested in, to use Salu's words, distributing poison, but they want to live like everybody else wants to live. And so that's where you have so many nuances about who the WA people are.
Yeah, I'm glad that stood out to you, because an easy cheap shot anyone could throw back at me is like, oh, you fall in love with this like narco state and you think it's some utopia. Of quite the opposite. I literally just wanted to describe it like any other government. And I think I've got another line in there like, look, the people who run WA State, A, mostly men, some dreamers, some quite cruel, most of them somewhere in between. I think that's probably a fair description of many governments around the world. If we're just going to write them off as a jungle mafia, or we're going to still do the updated versions of what British colonizers would have said, you know, ogres and savages and all that stuff. And now we'll just call them, drug traffickers. I mean, it carries that just like horrible negative weight. It's just really an unfortunate way to write off an entire race of people. I just argue that let's just acknowledge that this exists, that they created this. And sure, it's a narco state. Saudi Arabia is a petro state. I mean, that happens to be what drives their economy. I do think, having talked to a number of WA officials along the way, that if they could rid themselves of the drug trade and even take a financial hit, that they would do so. It brings too much drama. It really does. I mean, they do have tin mines and some other economic generators, but for now, a significant portion of their economy is going to have to rely on the drug trade. And you even see efforts now in WA State. Principally now, they've become even more sophisticated, and they primarily will rent a territory to an outside criminal syndicate, usually from China, and let them build the meth lab and bring in the chemist and take care of the international trafficking. And the WA government will just charge a tax. So they would call themselves like landlords. Even they will try to say, well, we're not really producing drugs anymore. And maybe to a large degree that's true. But you see these little efforts to distance themselves from it. The dream of someone like Saul Liu to move towards a less embarrassing economy still exists. So you're right. Most people haven't heard of the WA. Probably my book will be their introduction. But I hope that they can see them in a nuanced, balanced way and just talk about what they've created like any other government around the world. It's not perfect, but everything that they do for a reason. I'm interested in those reasons.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you for doing this work. It was a excellent read, and I'm glad that I had an opportunity to talk with you, and it was shared. There's a little, promo for the book that went out. This is one of the publishers sharing a former secretary to one of the drug lords that are in your book, saying it's unputdownable and authentic page turner, revealing why the global drug problem remains unsolved. And then again, so you can get this book anywhere that books are sold. I suppose this is a show that encourages independent bookstores if you are able to do so, because those are the ones that authors like yourself depend on for events, to go share it with people and stuff like that. But also it's a hardcover ebook and an audio version that's available. There's a link if you're watching this. It's simplebit.ly/narcotopia for different things related to the book. It's really good to talk with you, Patrick. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin. Great questions. And, yeah, thanks so much. That was a great conversation.